Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for June 5th, 2009. This week, we'll tell you how species lookalikes are wreaking havoc in the research world. We'll talk to a researcher who has created spider silk stronger than steel. And just in time for mosquito season, we'll explain exactly how these pesky insects find you. First off, though, Suzanne Bard learned about some disease-fighting frogs.
Frogs and other amphibians produce chemicals in their skin that ward off predators and fight disease.
So if a snake or a bird bites the amphibian, it probably tastes bad or it might sting the mouth. Some of them are actually poisons of the nervous system, so they'll disarm a predator. If the frog is cut, they kind of sterilize the wound. It's sort of a first aid kit for the frog.
Immunologist Louise Rollins Smith of Vanderbilt University says understanding how these compounds work could lead to breakthroughs in human medicine.
We work on a group of molecules called antimicrobial peptides. They're small compounds in the frog skin that can kill bacteria, kill viruses, and we discover that some of them are not only protective for frogs, but they might be useful for humans. And one of the viruses that some of the peptides destroy are the human immunodeficiency virus, the HIV virus.
She says once the disease-fighting molecules are identified, chemists can recreate them in the lab for further study.
Because these peptides are small molecules, they can actually be synthesized by a chemist, so you don't have to go to the frog. We can find out their secrets without hurting the frogs.
But Rollins Smith says that some of the potentially life-saving drugs we could get from amphibians may be lost before they're even discovered. That's because amphibians are facing a worldwide extinction crisis.
And if we lose the amphibians because of extinction, we'll miss that opportunity to learn about possible products that are in the frog skin.
Thanks for that report, Suzanne. Does anybody know, why amphibians are disappearing at this rate? Have they got a handle on that yet?
It's a combination of a fungus called the chytrid fungus, which is spreading at crazy rates around the world. And a lot of frogs, especially native frogs, don't have resistance to that. And also habitat loss plays a big role.
So is there any way to treat the fungus?
Well, another group of researchers is working on that problem right now, and there are some promising treatments. And the question is, how can they go from treating one frog to treating an entire population of frogs?
Right, sure. And also, they're probably worried about other effects on the environment when they, use that in a widespread way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's something that you have to think about with any kind of biocontrol agent.
Right. Okay, well, thank you, Suzanne. And while amphibians may be the hardest hit right now, countless species face extinction every day, and scientists are racing to find as many new organisms as they can before it's too late. Recently, scientists in Ecuador found a new variety of yeast. While not exactly a glamour species, yeasts are extremely important in fermentation for uses ranging from baking to creating biofuels.
And at Arizona State University, the International Institute for Species Exploration has announced their picks for the most interesting species discovered in 2008. The list includes a tiny seahorse just half an inch long and a stick insect that stretches nearly 2 feet. There's also a caffeine-free coffee plant, and proving that you never know where you'll find an exotic new creature, a tiny bacterium living in hairspray.
Wow, somehow life finds a way. All right, like many social insects, Argentinian ants operate a sort of morgue. They pile their dead outside the nest to reduce the spread of disease. Now, scientists have figured out how they tell truly dead nest mates from merely sluggish ones. Dungwon Che and his colleagues at the University of California, Riverside found that when ants that had died just a few minutes ago were dropped in a nest, the other ants left them alone.
But if I put the 1 hour dead ants into the nest, they promptly carried them away.
Further tests show that the ants identified their dead by chemicals called triglycerides. They're actually found in both living and dead ants, but living ants produce other chemicals that mask them. Che's team found that those masking chemicals dissipate within an hour post-mortem. Next, Justin Warner looks into a case of mistaken identity in the animal world.
Most worms may look alike to you and me, but scientists have generally assumed they can tell one species from another. Not so fast, according to zoologist Christer Ursaeus of the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. He and his colleagues have genetically analyzed various worms, comparing identical-looking specimens from different parts of the world, specimens that have long been classified as members of the same species.
And particularly when worms are common, when they are said to be found everywhere, the general pattern is that there are more than one under a single name.
For example, they found that one kind of freshwater worm actually included two distinct species. Now, exactly what constitutes a separate species is a matter of some debate, but one widely used yardstick is a maternally inherited gene called C1. By that measure, these worms are nearly twice as genetically different from each other as humans are from chimps. Specifically, Urseus says the C1 gene varies by less than 1% within the modern human species, 9% between humans and chimps, and 17% between these two groups of worms.
We have reasons to believe that in some way, the 17% difference between two worms is probably several million years worth of separate evolution.
So why does this matter beyond semantics? Well, Urseus notes that these two kinds of worms, like many others, are often used in scientific research, like toxicity studies. And the fact that they're so genetically different may be clouding the results. The work also may change our view of the planet's biodiversity. Urseus suspects that if we look more closely at genetics, we may find that the Earth has up to 10 times as many species as we thought.
Thanks, Justin. Next, most people look forward to summer, but they're usually less than enthusiastic about the coming mosquito season. Suzanne answers a listener's question about how they find their quarry.
Mosquitoes always seem to find us, despite our best efforts. And listener Bruce Robertson from Kalamazoo, Michigan, wrote to ask how they do it, since they're small and don't fly very quickly. We consulted entomologist Dennis LaPointe of the U.S. Geological Survey's Pacific Island Ecosystem Research Center in Hawaii. He says mosquitoes follow the plumes of carbon dioxide, or CO2, that warm-blooded animals exude.
They fly upwind, and they have kind of a casting flight, so they're going back and forth. And as they fly upwind into this plume, they're getting closer and closer to the source of the CO2.
Then when they've almost reached their target, the backyard pests use other chemical cues, as well as their ability to sense body heat and humidity, to home in on their prey. He adds that mosquitoes aren't that picky about where their next meal comes from.
In general, mosquitoes are not specific host feeders. Given an available blood host, they'll take any blood that they can get a hold of.
But he does say mosquitoes that feed at night seem to prefer birds, and those that feed during the day seem to prefer mammals like us. If you've got a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use it, you'll win a Science Update mug.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, unlike mosquitoes, spiders have to wait for their prey to come to them. But thanks to their amazing webs, this isn't much of a disadvantage. At the Max Planck Institute of Microstructure Physics in Germany, spider silk is providing chemist and materials scientist Mato Knez with clues to creating strong new materials. Knez and his colleagues wanted to see how a biomaterial would stand up to a harsh chemical process normally used in the semiconductor industry. So they went into the garden, found a spider, and collected some of its dragline silk. They found that the silk treated with this process not only stayed intact, but became very tough. In fact, Knez says it stretched almost twice as much as usual without breaking.
If you can apply this method to other materials, potentially even completely artificial materials like polymers, then it might be really technologically very interesting.
Knez says their results suggest that this might be a way to make lighter and more flexible materials. Finally today, Suzanne reports on new efforts to make cows a little greener.
Methane is a greenhouse gas 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And it turns out that burping cows are responsible for most of it. That's why geneticist Stephen Moore of the University of Alberta and his colleagues are looking for ways to make cows less gassy. They've found that certain cows can eat less, yet grow just as much as other cows. And according to Moore, they also belch out up to 25% less methane.
So you can actually breed animals that are more efficient and produce less methane. And then if you optimize both the feed and the animal, of course, you get a double whammy in the reduction of the amount of methane that animal would be producing.
Moore and his colleagues are now trying to identify the genes that help make these cattle more environmentally friendly.
Thanks, Suzanne. You've given us all something on which to ruminate.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay, well, that's our show for this week. Next week, the latest news from NASA and beyond. We'll tell you how the Messenger spacecraft is shedding light on Mercury's mysteries and how stars become either supernovas or black holes. Until then, check out our Science Update Podcast Daily Edition. We've got a new story every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.